Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening. I'm co-host Ron Edwards. This is the Ron and Don Show, coming to you from the Arctic Circle, if you will, of the Twin Cities of Minneapolis and St. Paul. I tell you, it has been some wicked weather the last couple of days. As we speak from studios, wind chill is down around 28, 29, below zero, if you will. Actual ground temperature seems to be about 11 below zero. Oh, it's been brutal. Up in Duluth, Minnesota, air temperature there, 41 degrees below zero. In Barris, Minnesota, which is normally the coldest place in the continental United States, is around 52 below zero as we speak. That's not wind chill, my friends. That's the actual ground temperature. It is unbelievable. It is brutal. You can almost tell it by the number of cars that are not on the street. Hey, that's the way it is. Like I said, we're coming to you from the top of the world, if you will. Well, going to look at a number of issues. Co-host Don Allen will not be with us again this evening. Mr. Allen is on an academic assignment, if you will. In fact, he probably will not be with us for the month of January. We thought that he was going to join us for one of the Martin Luther King month celebrations and reflections, if you will, but it appears that that might not be the case. But we will continue in the tradition of the show must go on to, quote-unquote, carry the mantle, if you will, of communication and broadcasting. And there's a lot going on. First and foremost, condolences go out to the nation of France and to the French people. People are saying on social media and et cetera, that I too am French, if you will, coming as an outgrowth of a murderous attack on a left-wing French magazine, if you will, in Paris, in the center of Paris, by the way. At least 12 dead, 11 wounded. All 12 of the dead, 10 journalists, 8 cartoonists, and et cetera, for the magazine Charlie. 2 French national policemen gunned down by at least 3 terrorists, if you will, firing AK-47 assault weapons and et cetera. There seemed to be some kind of search going on about 100 miles outside of France, outside of Paris, excuse me, according to all of the major cable networks. Also, we're monitoring here in studio BBC, CNN, MSNBC, everyone. We also have shortwave radio set up, listening to Radio Paris, if you will, English language broadcast. This assault, which took place early in the morning in Paris, certainly shaken the very foundation of French institutions and et cetera. The issue is being enunciated as one having to deal with the insulting of the Muslim religion, of the Prophet Muhammad, if you will, and other aspects of the ongoing conflict between East and West, if you will, between Christendom and Islam, if you will. And so it's been turned up just a tad. This comes, of course, on the heels of ISIS, showing the world just how much brutality can be delivered in the beheading of Western journalists and et cetera. Quite obvious, this is a very subtle message to Western media, Western journalists, that where they are not wanted and where they don't have approval or authorization, or where it is that they take on subject matter that is considered to be offensive, if you will, to the Muslim religion, there will be consequences, if you will. Tonight's program, we will not be taking phone calls. We will be going straight into a number of discussions, starting, as we said, with the carnage in Paris earlier today. We're then going to take a look at an event that has taken place here that should not have caught people by surprise, but apparently it did, and that is the retiring to senior status by one of the most respected and beloved African American, or for that matter, any federal judge, the Honorable Michael J. Davis, Chief Judge of the Federal District Court for the Federal District of Minnesota. Judge Davis announcing on December 31st that he is taking senior status and he will be leaving his position as Chief Judge of the Federal Bench here in Minnesota. This comes at a troubling time because it does not appear, if you will, that African-American leadership was prepared to have a candidate in place, well entrenched, if you will, and be prepared to have that name or a couple of names submitted to the review committee, which then reports to the two United States senators for the state of Minnesota. That's Senior Senator Klobuchar and just once again newly reelected Al Franken, who will then pass it on to the Obama administration. Resumes have to be in by January 9th. It's just a couple of days from now, really. It does not appear that the, again, African-American leadership was in a position. And then the last half hour of tonight's program, we're going to take a look at a renewed controversy that has exploded on social media here in the Twin Cities involving one of the most legendary informants in the history of, quote-unquote, police-community relations that led to actually the destruction, the actual destruction of the Black Police Officers Association, though there was no clear indication that any large number of black officers were involved in corruption, drug dealing, and et cetera. But this informant, who goes by the name of Velache, legendary in this part of the state, and we have some very interesting information in the last half hour of tonight's program. We will be going until 9:30 Central Standard Time. But back to France, back to Paris, if you will, back to the state of emergency that is in existence as we speak in that nation, if you will. A well-planned military-style attack. Clearly, the gunmen, they say there are three. Latest news just in the last 5 or 6 minutes as we are watching the different broadcasting entities. A 18-year-old individual has surrendered, apparently as being an outgrowth of being identified as one of the three individuals at the scene of the attack on the left-wing magazine this afternoon. Again, as we said, 12 shot and killed, at least 9 of them employees of the magazine Charlie, 2 French national policemen gunned down execution style. France is on full alert at the highest possible level, if you will, of terrorist alert. French military units being deployed at certain locations, if you will. Peaceful demonstrations in Paris and Marseille and other large French cities, as we speak, indicating solidarity and extreme sympathy for those that were shot and killed early this morning. Europe, many places in Europe, stunned by the attack. But as we said, what is troubling is how well coordinated this attack was. It is quite clear that the gunman, again, we are not clear here in the United States, unless you're with the CIA, NSA, and et cetera, even with the nationalities, though they are maintaining that the 18-year-old who allegedly surrendered in the last, 3 to 4 hours in or just outside of Paris is of North African descent, if you will, and is clearly a Muslim. And so that is certainly increasing tension, religious and racial tensions in France, if you will. The French president has spoken a couple times to the nation. President Barack Obama has offered American assistance which of course includes intelligence information, etc. French news services are saying that the oldest of the two brothers who are being looked at were under some kind of surveillance. That seems to be a normal kind of declaration nowadays. After one of these incidents takes place, the authorities always attempt to leave the general public with the impression that the existence of the individuals and the presence of the plan of terrorist act was halfway known, somewhat known, about to be known, if you will. One, I think, at some point has to question that. The American intelligence community indicating that the oldest brother may have some relationships, quote unquote, whatever that means, however you define that, however you craft that, shape that, and et cetera. Relationships here in the United States has caused Homeland Security to indicate that it is going to a moderate, notice we did not say highest possible alert, but they are going to a moderate level in regards to surveillance, if you will. You can imagine that the telephone traffic, if you will, cyber traffic and et cetera has greatly increased, and with that the listening in and et cetera, whatever texting is going on, whatever kinds of cyber messages are going back and forth around the world, the good old NSA is on it and quote unquote assessing, providing transcripts and et cetera, analyzing the discussions and et cetera. There are probably Muslim organizations here in the United States as we speak that are already under significant scrutiny, covert agents and operatives, double agents and et cetera, clearly are on alert to provide as much information as possible if their ability of a hit, if you will, any kind of action against any American assets inside of the United States of America, though the Obama White House will indicate that they are on top of this, and as we said before, at best there is maybe a moderate, we use that word again for the third or fourth time, there is a moderate rise in the level, quote-unquote, of possible terrorist activity against the assets and interest of the United States. So we will watch that closely in the coming hours, if you will. The possibility of additional attacks in France, attacks in the Netherlands, Belgium, particularly Germany, if you will, particularly those European nations that have a fairly large Muslim population or even African population to the extent of embracing Islam, that is fully engaged, if you will. We will not know for another couple days actually what generated this, but it was clear, and we said this earlier, that this was a well-planned, well-coordinated attack. Gunmen, very heavily armed, knew what they were doing, entered the building, entered the offices of the magazine, called people out by name, then separated them by gender, and then proceeded to execute at least 9 of those that, 10 of them actually, that were there in the office. 8 were cartoonists, part of the editorial staff and et cetera. So there had been surveying had been going on for quite some time. I mean, anytime you come into a facility, you have the names of the people that you are there to execute, if you will. You've been watching it for quite some time. In 2011, the magazine Charlie was the target of a firebomb attack as an outgrowth of their support of a Danish cartoonist and writer who had defamed, if you will, disrespected Islam and the Prophet Muhammad. And even then, the French authorities, particularly the French Sûreté, the French intelligence agency, had indicated, and this sounds familiar too, doesn't it, that homegrown terrorists, quote-unquote, were preparing a series of actions. And there had been some isolated, if you could call them that, actions, including an attack on a couple of police officers in a small rural French town, the deaths of what, four Jewish worshippers at a synagogue. There have been other individual, very, very individual attacks, if you will, like people being injured, shot, killed, that kind of thing. France is, though they talk greatly of their tolerance, if you will, and benevolence, France has gained a reputation over the last 10 to 15 years as having some serious religious and race problems, if you will, in its relationship with its subjects who have flocked to France, particularly from North Africa, to a lesser degree from Southeast Asia, if you will. People tend to forget that the country formerly known as Indochina, then later as North and South Vietnam, now as Vietnam, was a French colonial possession, if you will. And so we know the history of the French, excuse me, and their quote unquote colonial powers, Africa, Asia, South America, and of course the United States, if you will. And so these things are at play. But we watch, as we said before, we watch closely what will happen, how it will happen. One has to imagine, though, that there is something being planned for the United States. Will it happen in 2015? I don't think anyone can really predict or project that. But you figure early 2016 could be a point in time where some kind of sensational, maybe not anything along the lines of the Twin Towers, 9/11, but you have to envision that the way that some of these groups, Al-Qaeda, ISIS, and others are operating, where they are inflicting significant casualties on persons, if you will, in situations in which it is graphically captured. Going into a supermarket, a theater, if you will. That's why I just don't think people should dismiss the whole controversy relevant to the movie Interview and try to dismiss, quote-unquote, the anger of the North Koreans. Because it is easy to obtain the services for the right amount of money or for the right passion of those who will become contract agents, if you will, for the particular proposition that is at play, and carry out acts, if you will, and then give it a name after the carnage, if you will, in the name of whomever. This has long been the history. The CIA, by the way, prides itself on maneuvering, manipulating, and developing those kinds of scenarios to keep people at each other's throats. When this country began to see others could do it just about as good as the United States, then it became a issue of concern over the last 30, 35, 40 years. And so for that reason, we would say here on this program that one has to feel, based on what happened in Paris today, or actually yesterday, Paris time, that something is being set in place. There are enough ingredients, if you will. Oh, we've not forgotten Ferguson and Cleveland and New York and places like that. You know, just a couple nights ago, two New York City patrol officers responding to a stick-up call of a Chinese restaurant in the Bronx, shot and wounded. Both of them are out of danger. One shot in the back, the other was shot in the arm. The first reports out of New York City on all of the cable networks was that this was a continued escalation of the conditions that currently exist inside of New York City. So as one watches that, I guess if I were, quote-unquote, a planner, notice how we said that, if I were a planner, hypothetical, for an Al-Qaeda cell or et cetera, would certainly take advantage of the level of hostility, if you will, and carry out an action that would lay the blame at the movers and shakers of, quote-unquote, the social consciousness movement that has taken hold after Ferguson and after Gardner in New York and after Cleveland, Ohio, and places like that. We apologize. I'll tell you, flu is rampant up in this part of the country. So we continue to keep our eyes on the prize, if you will. On a very firm and positive note, particularly coming on Martin Luther King birthday, Martin Luther King month, if you will, then segueing into Black history. One of the great legal minds, one of the great jurists, judges in the history of the federal court of the state of Minnesota, and served with great distinction on the Hennepin County District Court bench, Judge Michael J. Davis, as we said at the top of the program, has announced that he will be stepping aside as the Chief Judge of the Federal District Court for Minnesota. He was the first African American ever nominated and confirmed as a federal judge in the state of Minnesota, and has served with distinction in that position for a little over 21 years, if you will. He will be moving on, as we said, to that senior status. And so last couple of newspaper articles in the Minneapolis Star Tribune, the largest newspaper here in the state of Minnesota, including in this morning's edition of the paper on the editorial page, a reflection by the editorial board of the Star Tribune, though Judge Davis laid out these expectations a couple days ago, that diversity must continue to be the order of the day on the federal bench. And we say amen, and we certainly hope that that would happen. But we're puzzled by a couple of things. One foremost, if you will, that anybody who says that they are familiar with the judiciary, if you will, with the politics and et cetera, all of these experts and leaders that we have in our city who maintain that they're on top of all the issues should have had nominees in place, names in place, before the formal announcement on the 31st of December 2014 from Judge Davis. Judge Davis had been sending signals for the last year that he would exercise the tradition. He was appointed to serve a 7-year term as chief judge, if you will. And the history in the Federal District of Minnesota has been that all the previous chief judges served the 7 years, depending on their health, if you will, then take the senior status, if you will, and that a heir apparent is in place. About less than a year ago, some of the leaders out there met with Junior Senator Al Franken, who was soliciting for the first time again in 6 years the votes of an African American community, which made the difference for both he and later Governor Mark Dayton, both Democrats, to win their seats. There was a meeting at the Urban League of Minneapolis, and in that meeting, prior to that meeting, it had been suggested that Senator Franken, and Senator Klobuchar, who is the senior senator for the state in the state of Minnesota, would be asked to state their position and their thinking on making sure that an African American continued to hold a seat on the federal court. That particular evening at the Urban League, there was no one apparently there amongst the leaders, and it was by invitation only. So, you know, if you were not a part of the True Blue Club, you were not invited, you were not allowed to come in, security would have would have stopped you. You have a sitting United States senator on the premises in the middle of a high crime area. So the question about an heir to succeed Judge Michael J. Davis never came up, never was talked about. So I've watched as a journalist and a historian for the last number of months what kind of preparation was going on. I did not even begin to hear any discussion about the fact that, and obviously in 2014, that Judge Davis was now in his seventh year as chief judge, moving into his 21st year on the federal bench, and was clearly indicating that he was prepared to move to senior status, if you will, which would mean he would continue to be on the bench with a reduced workload and et cetera, but he would not be the chief judge. And as we said earlier, that is a part of how the political game is handled in the world of political activity, if you will, consideration, strategy, and et cetera, and particularly in the judiciary. Well, now, we have this situation. As we said before, this morning's edition, Minneapolis Star Tribune, talks about the importance of diversity. I'm afraid, though, the Star Tribune is talking about a female of the Caucasian persuasion to be considered, and there are a couple of strong ones that are being quietly positioned. Though the paper and a reporter for the Star Tribune over the last week has indicated Wilhelmina Wright, a very gifted African-American associate justice of the Minnesota State Supreme Court. She has moved very rapidly up through the ranks in the last 3 to 4 years, if you will. First appointed about a decade ago as a judge in the Ramsey County being the site of the state capital of Minnesota, St. Paul. Wilhelmina worked quietly and then, as we said before, quietly moved up, fell at court, and then catapulted to an associate justice of the state Supreme Court. Now, this morning's edition of the paper implied that certainly there needed to be appropriate consideration, et cetera, because we have no historical institution here in the state of Minnesota that is controlled and operated by the African-American community. Our community is really devoid of information, and historical information so important to being able to craft and understand the politics that surrounds a community, that being us, the African-American community. The fact of the matter is that 21 years ago, an African-American district court judge by the name of Pam Alexander was also nominated by the late Senator Paul Wellstone. Judge Alexander, a very gifted jurist, if you will, highly thought of, and was thought to have to be a shoe-in. Initially, she was not originally selected because of the political pressures that were being applied. Senator Wellstone was told that there was another individual, the U.S. Attorney for the Federal District of Minnesota at that time, a man by the name of Litherhall, deserved to have the second slot. There was a falling out between Wellstone and the U.S. Attorney, and the late Senator Wellstone withdrew his nomination of Mr. Litherhall, and at that time announced that he was substituting the nomination of Judge Pam Alexander. And there was great euphoria within the African-American community and some segments of the white liberal community. But we had said then, as a journalist and to TV commentator and et cetera, that we were detecting some real bad vibes coming from some very, very powerful individuals led by former Vice President Walter Mondale, who had in fact insisted to Senator Wellstone that U.S. Attorney Lilly Hyde be the second choice. But because of the strong philosophical departure between those two men, Senator Wellstone, who was a man of great honor, if you will, integrity, and et cetera, jettisoned that nomination and put in the name of our District Court Judge Pam Alexander. Well, what happened, the Clinton administration started acting strangely, if you will, and the nomination of Judge Pam Alexander of the Hennepin County District Court languished for 2 years. I can well remember the different activities, luncheons and brunches and et cetera, as there were so many African Americans and particularly professional black women who were very proud. Judge Alexander, a daughter, quote unquote, of Minnesota, if you will, along with Judge LeJune Lang, who, if Paul Wellstone would have had his way, would have also been nominated if there would have been a third opening. In fact, at one point, the Wellstone camp talked in terms of Judge Lang being nominated for one of the federal magistrates to position her for the next opening on the federal bench. It did not happen. Using some very ugly kinds of rumors and allegations, all unfounded and primarily not against Judge Alexander, but against members of her family, Paul Wellstone withdrew her nomination, if you will, and so consequently the African American community saw the opportunity for a significant history making action, and that was to have, in a state with as small a population of color, particularly African American population, that we would have seen two African Americans on the federal court here in the state of Minnesota. People don't talk about it anymore here. That's really unfortunate because they need to. They need to take a look at how the Democratic Party treated the nomination of Pam Alexander. In fact, in the two stories that have just been written in the Minneapolis Star Tribune, you see no mention of the fact that not only was Judge Davis nominated, but that a short period of time later, very short period of time, Hennepin County District Judge Pam Alexander was nominated. Judge Alexander, who briefly left the district court here a couple years ago, has quietly returned. She's doing kind of some senior work and activity, if you will. But it was quite clear that her spirit and the spirit of her supporters was broken, if you will, in fact, shattered. And there was never any accountability on why her nomination was opposed. But in the final analysis, Judge Michael J. Davis moved on with great, quote-unquote, commitment, if you will, success, if you will, courage, tenaciousness, all of the words in question. And he epitomizes what it is that a African-American must bring, male or female, must bring to, quote-unquote, the corridors and the halls of, quote-unquote, the judiciary system. And so though he will continue his senior status, we take the opportunity, particularly as one who served with him 30 years ago almost on the Minneapolis Civil Rights Commission when it used to mean something, I had the privilege and the honor of being the chairman of the commission, and as a part of my executive committee of the Minneapolis Civil Rights Commission, on that committee was Judge Michael J. Davis, Pam Alexander, and LeJune Lang, all who were appointed on the same day by the late Governor Rudy Perfitt almost 30 years ago to the Hennepin County bench, joining then Judge Poston, who had actually become the second African-American, succeeding a man by the name of L. Howard Bennett, who was appointed to the Hennepin County Municipal Court. See, people don't even know we used to have municipal court in 1959. L. Howard Bennett, who became in 1960 the first sitting judge in 35 years to lose. Really, this is the truth, my friends, to lose an election, if you will. But he went on to serve the Johnson administration. He had an extreme godfather, if you will, in the form of Cecil Newman and the late, all are now deceased, Cecil Newman, and, of course, again, Nellie Stone Johnson. But if there was anyone who worked tirelessly for that historical decision and announcement almost 30 years ago, when Governor Rudy Perpich announced that attorneys Davis, Alexander, and Lang were being appointed to the Hennepin County bench, it was the legendary and beloved Nellie Stone Johnson. And so that is a part of history. As you hear discussions here in Minnesota over the next couple of weeks about who will succeed Judge Davis on the federal court bench and with permanent status, if you will, who will become the chief judge of the federal bench in Minnesota, keep in mind the names of people such as Nellie Stone Johnson, Cecil Newman, if you will, people of principle who worked extremely hard to maintain the dream. But, you know, we have to say again that it is unfortunate that we have no historical vehicle or vessel, if you will, that keeps us enlightened. Probably what we just got through telling you in the last 10 or 12 minutes, probably three-fourths of you here in Minnesota knew nothing about it. So that is most unfortunate. Well, moving on to this controversy that has emerged and has opened old wounds here within the city of Minneapolis and particularly in law enforcement. And we have a better understanding because for those out there that did follow this, the whole matter of so-called black police corruption in 2008, 2009, that the case brought by Lieutenant Michael Keith, a Caucasian officer, one of the most courageous police officers and human beings you'd ever want to see. We would refer those of you who like your computers and like to, you know, mouse up, if you will, to go back and take a look at a four-part series in the Minneapolis Star Tribune starting on April 19th, 2009. It's entitled The Informant. And the headline, we will touch on the other three chapters, if you will, but the headline indicated that word on the street was that some Minneapolis cops were dirty, tipping off drug dealers. Investigators knew one man who could help them figure out if that was true, was gang leader Taylor Trump, a.k.a. Bolacci, and et cetera. Nice picture of Brother Bolacci. I've known him for many, 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 many years. Nice picture of him in that first article in the Sunday edition of the Minneapolis Star Tribune. Back there in April 19th of 2009. And I tell you, the role that law enforcement had Brother Bolacci playing, if you will, was rather interesting. The second article the following day, Putting Cops to the Test, that's when informant, now this is the Star Tribune, if you will, when informant Taylor Trump identified cops he alleged were corrupt, investigators decided to see if they could catch the police officers in the act. And featured in this particular story was Lieutenant Lee Edwards. No relationship, if you will, though I've known Lee since he came here from Detroit, not Chicago, as Bolacci told investigators, which blew up in his face. The next and third article was entitled On a Collision Course. chapter 3. Not everyone believed Taylor Trump, the informant. They keep calling him informant. Lieutenant Michael Keith made it his business to determine if the gang leader was telling the truth. And, man, I tell you, that is one that I think that my good friend Valachi forgot about as he's been talking back and forth on social media, if you will. He should have remembered chapter 3, if you will. And for those of you that really want to be up to speed, that was the April 21st edition of the Minneapolis Star-Tribune. And then the final piece, the following day, big, full, above the fold and everything, entitled Police Versus the Police. And again, a big picture of our friend Valachi, a.k.a. Valachi, if you will, who was about to go back to the penitentiary. But anyways, pictures in there, Michael Keith, Lee Edwards, a woman, a very courageous woman who actually had the information that would have saved police officer Mike Roberts from going to the penitentiary for 1 year, not for police corruption, but for income taxes. See, people still run around talking about police corruption, and et cetera. Mike Roberts, who at the time of his sentencing was the most senior African-American officer in the police department with about 32 years at that time. Officer Roberts was not found guilty of the violation of police integrity. Information was provided to the federal government, actually by a man that was his commander, officer who now works for the University of Minnesota, and his wife, who ran one of the businesses in downtown Minneapolis, if you will, a night spot there, an after-hour night spot where black folk go and spend their money. And that was former Commander Mike Martin. Mike, you know, if you hear this, somebody plays the tape for you. You know, we all know and understand what your roles were. And then there was, oh, my God, Grant Schneider, O'Rourke, Pat King, who is now over in the Sheriff's Department, just went over there a couple weeks ago, if you will, now heading the Sheriff's Department's Special Gang Task Force, routing folks in North Minneapolis, if you will, bringing order, if you will, and et cetera. So all of this is at play. And then a couple months later, there was a lawsuit filed by a group called the Mill City Five. Nice picture of them in the newspaper, dated February 1st, 2008, if you will, which is what led to the Star Tribune doing its report in 2009, if you will. Things were supposed to start. Mill City Five, Adams, Hamilton, Harris, El Redondo, and Lee Edwards, if you will. That makes interesting reading. Why did we bring this up? We didn't. We've been looking at the social postings and et cetera. It is wild out there, the allegations and statements being made back and forth. But what we were puzzled by is how folks forgot the things that they said in these newspaper articles, this four-part chapter in April of 2009, if you will. And folks saying that, well, they had to be an informant because they were looking at a strike three and et cetera. I don't think that was quite accurate, if you will. May have been strike one, and you had strike two, and then they brought you back from the Carolinas and brought you up to a courtroom about a year and a half ago in Duluth, closed the doors, and the feds talked in terms of what it is they expected out of their favorite person, their CCI, that's Certified Confidential Informant. That's the top of the line, if you will. Now, the Star Tribune got a hell of a break a couple of weeks ago when a novice, if you will, district court judge threw out most of Michael Keith's lawsuit, which has been going on for over 6 years. Now, I got to tell you, anytime a lawsuit can hold sway in the federal courts for over 6 years, it's got to be something there. But there were some parts of it that the feds pushed back to the state. Well, anyways, part of what was thrown out was a motion, a series of motions to find a Pacific Minneapolis Star Tribune reporter in contempt and perjury, if you will, as it pertains to information that he used to write about not only then Lieutenant Michael Keith, but also black officers back in 06, 07, and 08. And with the decision to dismiss most of Officer Michael Keith's state complaint, if you will, the Star Tribune feels that they're off the hook. And the feds have given the go-ahead to their main man, if you will, Balach, my man Balach, to start making some movement, if you will, start laying out some of the things that he had said before a grand jury and then on the stand. There were some of you that are probably listening to this program were in the courtroom over there in St. Paul when Balach testified, if you will, with regards to his role and what it is he knew and his relationship with the feds, but actually it was his relationship with the VOTAC unit, that is the Violent Offenders Task Force, which ultimately was disbanded because of the problems that they had created for the city, though they were then Chief Tim Dolan's favorite group. And there are documents. There, in fact, there is a 4,000-page document, if you will, that lays out in the course of 6 years, 6.5, 7 years of depositions and et cetera, a very concise plan by then, and some of them are still there. Others have transferred out, as we said, gone to work for the University of Minnesota, gone to work for the Sheriff's Department, just took retirement, and et cetera, to destroy the Black Police Officers Association. There apparently was a lot of animus directed towards some of the African-American police officers, particularly such as Sergeant Charles Adams. Now, by the way, now Deputy Chief, congratulations. He just took his position yesterday, the day before yesterday, actually, Monday, and that is Deputy Chief at Redondo, if you will. And there was a lot of animus, a lot of racism in that department, and some of it still continues, unfortunately. The union president, John DeMonico, has been a man of fairness and principle, and I think it's important that I say that on this program. As a former federal monitor for 5 years of the Minneapolis Police Department, yes, 2004 to 2008, if you will, and of course, before that, as a federal overseer on behalf of the federal court for the Minneapolis Fire Department, yours truly, irrespective of what one may think about one, has a pretty good history, pretty good idea, pretty good experience with regards to how things kind of work in this enclave, if you will, this area that, quote-unquote, we, quote-unquote, do business. But for those that are on their websites tonight and social media and back and forth and the allegations and recriminations and et cetera, you need to call up the Minneapolis Star Tribune's four-part chapter on the informant. That's the heading now. It's not something we made up here on this program, if you will. And read it in its entirety, you know. And then if you can get it done, you need to see if you can retrieve the 4,000-page document that the city attorney has been trying to redact everything but the lines in the document into the disappearing, if you will, becoming stilted, if you will. That's how heavy that document is. But with the district court judge, with her ruling that most of Lieutenant Michael Keith's allegations cannot be sustained, whatever that's supposed to mean in that context, the Star Tribune has gotten a pass again, if you will. In fact, it's one of the reasons that the reporter Paul McEnroe, if you will, though about 3 months ago had promised that he would lobby his editors at the Star Tribune to publish the 4,000-page report so the public, and particularly the black community, could understand who it was that was really running the dope, the drugs, and et cetera, through the African-American community. And by the way, I saw some postings yesterday in which folks kept talking about the female who was a snitch, and of course who they were talking about is Shayla Haynes, a very courageous African-American woman who probably was forced into a relationship after her husband was mysteriously murdered in a doorway there in front of the Plymouth Avenue townhouse apartments, if you will. That was a real funny homicide, if you will. A big hitter, a big player had wanted her, if you will, had approached her. She had rebuffed him. Her husband is then shot and killed, and no sooner than the funeral was over, the player showed up and said, "I'm here to help you. I know you need money and et cetera, and I want you to run a house for me along the 1300 block of Xerxes Avenue in North Minneapolis." Oh, by the way, the Xerxes address, the Xerxes house and et cetera is contained in one of the chapters. Again, not something that we made up, but information that comes from the FBI, if you will, the alcohol tax and firearms, if you will, Minneapolis Police Intelligence Units, the Minneapolis Internal Affairs. Because I tell you, that house at 13th and Xerxes, woo, there was stuff going on in there. There are photographs and videos which were withheld during the Mike Roberts trial. I have no idea why his attorney, Clayton Tyler, did not information and evidence into the record and into testimony. Only he can explain that, if you will. But there is some interesting reflections, particularly with regards to the young African-American women. They were being sold as sex slaves, if you will, to law enforcement officers, if you will. And in fact, as we said, there was video of transactions and et cetera, drugs, money and et cetera being paid across the table there in the kitchen in that house at 1313 Xerxes, if you will. It's all there. For those that like the wolf and talk and et cetera, they obviously forgot that many of them made themselves available. Again, the headline for four consecutive days, "The Informant." That was the headline by the Star Tribune. They thought at one point, actually, I remember some of the discussion, Star Tribune was actually working to get a Pulitzer Prize. They did get a regional prize for this investigative report. But they were surprised that there, with the exception, unfortunately, of Officer Mike Roberts, there were no other African-American officers. And what happened, by the way, for those that are out there, like, how in the hell could this happen and nobody dealt with it? The five, the Mill City Five that we named earlier, Adams, Hamilton, Harris, Edwards, if you will, and Arredondo, did settle for $750,000 as it pertains to the attempt to destroy their careers. As we said, some have hung on, if you will, and continue to be involved in law enforcement and serve their community, if you will. Some have gone on to significant positions of command. None of them were taken down, but on the other hand, their white counterparts, particularly that crew that was initially identified by Lieutenant Michael Keith before the ground was cut out from under him. By the way, Lieutenant Michael Keith had been the commander of the VOTEC unit. He made the mistake of going to an assistant U.S. attorney and telling him the kind of corruption that was going on before Mike Keith could get on the elevator over at the federal building to get down to the main floor. That U.S. assistant U.S. attorney had called Chief Tim Dolan and told him, "You got a problem in your unit." The next day, Lieutenant Michael Keith was transferred, really, to the Empire lot. I mean, that's a fact. It's in the story. It's in that portion, if you will, of chapter, quote unquote, three, that chapter that talks in terms of on a collision course, and also that chapter four that talks in terms of the police versing the police, if you will. It's all there. I did not think that I would see a rekindling of this. There had been agreements and et cetera amongst any number of parties, if you will, that this would, a lid would be kept on this, particularly to protect the Star Tribune and to protect white law enforcement officers who had to be protected, if you will. This reminds me, in closing tonight's program, of the trial about 2 years ago when then Sergeant Pat King and Lieutenant Andy Smith sued, not Chief Dolan, though, but sued Chief Deputy Chief Jhené Harto and others, and maintained that they had been violated and falsely accused. Judge heard the case and ruled against them. And some of the testimony at that trial was just unbelievable. Randy First, my good friend Randy First, covered that trial. It's too bad he didn't write about that, some of that testimony from Pat King and Andy Smith when they called some of those black police officers the scum of the earth. Yes, they did. Yes, they did. In that courtroom, they called them the scum of the earth. It was being heard by a judge, not by a jury. All parties had agreed. And I'll never forget the venom that I heard from some of these white police officers. O'Rourke, well remembers his testimony. The only two heroes in that whole scenario was then Deputy Chief Gerlacher and now Chief of Police Jhené Harto, if you will. Unfortunately, for those of you in the general public, you were not privy to the kind of venom, the kind of testimony. I mean, now Deputy Chief Arredondo and Sergeant Adams and Patrol Officer Tony Adams, his brother, et cetera, were called scumbags. And that was just 2 years ago. That was how much hatred. Of course, part of the reason was that some of these white officers were trying to explain to what happened to $60,000 of DEA money that got lost in Chicago. As we said before, the kind of things that folks don't talk about. But to my friends, if you will, to the graduate of Pinnell St. Margaret's, if you will, be careful on what you say and what you ask for, if you will, because in this age of cyber, and geez, enough of y'all play with cyber out there to know that it'll come back to haunt you, you may want to check and see what it was that you gave interviews for and what you testified to, if you will. We know you'll never tell what it was that you were told in that closed session in that federal courtroom in Duluth, Minnesota, about a year and a half ago. But I don't know, maybe you get pumped up enough, you may. Well, appreciate you allowing us to spend this time with you. We hope that it has been a part of, well, the tradition of January and February, which is Martin Luther King Month and Black History. I guess those are supposed to be our 2 months, if you will. And we say again for the fourth or fifth time, it is tragic that after going through $3 million that the sponsors of what was supposed to be the African American Black History Museum never got it off the ground. I mean, they got the money spent, you know, in all the wrong places, but they never spent the money on the museum. And man, does this community need a corner of that museum to talk in terms of even some of the current events. Well, I'll be back with you next Wednesday. As I said before, my co-host, Mr. Don Allen, is on academic assignment. Man, that sounds powerful. You know what I'm saying? The man is doing some heavy stuff with his academics, if you will. Well, on behalf of the Don Ron Group, we want to wish you a warm and comfortable evening. But more importantly, be safe in America. Good night.